Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us on The Conversation. It is Monday, June 24th. Historic properties are starting to be affected by the rising insurance costs. We'll hear about the trends starting to emerge on the continental U.S. and an upcoming webinar. We'll also talk about our endangered birds and the planned release of bacteria to help them survive, not just on Maui, but Kauai too. And following up on those gifts from FESPAC 2024, we'll hear more on the plan to exhibit the artifacts to the public. Plus, an exhibit on the Big Island explores the intersection of textiles and culture. Adaptive frameworks is the theme. The conversation starts right after the latest headlines. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Picky, picky, picky. That's what we're seeing from insurance companies with the recent losses due to disasters over the last few years. And while many of the headlines of recent months have to do with condominium insurance, what about historic homes? Well, some property owners are starting to get dropped by their carriers. The National Trust for Historic Preservation is holding a webinar next month that will help historic properties understand what's at play in the market. Kevin Sullivan is with the National Trust Insurance Services and will be a panelist on the forum. We reached him in Baltimore, where he is based, to talk about what owners of historic properties need to know about the challenging insurance marketplace.
The overall issue is more with the overall insurance market. So whether it's commercial or historic properties, what have you, the property insurance market in the last 36 months has just been chaotic, to say the least. And it really has to come down to the profitability of insurance companies. Obviously, they're in it to make a profit. And with climate-related disasters, there's been a lot of what they call billion-dollar weather events, whether it's a wildfire or a hurricane or a tornado or whatever it might be. There's just been a higher prevalence of these issues since 2020. So really, 2020, 2021, and 2022 were among the three worst years in the last 50 years. So that led to a reduced profitability from the insurance company. Their costs have gone up. So their costs for claims handling, their reinsurance costs have gone up. And what's happened is you find these insurance companies who are becoming much more picky as it relates to what they insure. So when they are being picky, unfortunately, one of the first things that they look to not insure are complicated property placements, such as historic properties. So the old saying, you know, the baby being thrown out with the bathwater, what's happened is historic properties have always been challenging to insure. But with the overall insurance market being challenging, it's just expedited the harshness of historic properties. Finding more and more historic homeowners and historic building owners having problems really just procuring any insurance, much less affordable insurance or competitive insurance.
Okay, and the outlook is probably not going to improve for a while.
I would say the outlook is TBD, to be determined. It's mostly a, you know, we're in a kind of wait-and-see mode to see what happens with the property insurance market. It's been getting worse and worse over the last 36 months, though I will say we're at a point now within the last 6 months where it hasn't gotten much worse. So it's, I wouldn't call it necessarily good news, but it's no more bad news type of situation. And, you know, hopefully what we'll find is that the property insurance carriers will find their footing and start being aggressive again in terms of what they insure, how they insure, and certainly how they price their insurance. So we really have to wait and see how that'll play out. As I mentioned, a lot of their costs are tied up to reinsurance, which is, in very layman's terms, insurance for the insurance companies. And their reinsurance costs have gone up. And the construction market is continues to be expensive from a labor and material standpoint. So as long as those areas start to stabilize, you'll find that the property insurance carriers will be much more aggressive. But we're waiting and seeing at this point.
You know, we're just at the beginning of hurricane season here, and they're predicting a milder season. But, you know, all it takes is one, and it's tough because so many homes here, particularly on Oahu, are wooden. There's just more of them here. And we have lots of high-rises, you know, with glass windows. So that makes people nervous if we were to get a Category 5 storm. But what can you tell us about the situation with ownership of historic homes across the mainland? What's happening there?
Yeah, so when you mention hurricane season, the part that is not great is you could find a great hurricane season in your geography, meaning you don't have any catastrophic storms for, you know, a couple years. But if our friends and neighbors in a different part of the country are getting, you know, hit hard with hurricanes, it affects the overall insurance market. So it's not just one particular area that could be problematic. Really what happens to the entire U.S. insurance market. So that's, you know, one thing that I'll say. And obviously we all hope for our easy hurricane seasons that makes everybody's lives easier. You know, even if you're buying or even if you own a home in Michigan, you root for a favorable hurricane season in Florida because a bad hurricane season in Florida affects the entire insurance market and everybody's affected. Now, as it relates to historic homeowners in your particular geography, it really comes down to how the overall insurance market fares. So if the overall insurance market continues to improve, stabilizes and continues to improve, what you generally find is you find more insurance carriers that are willing to open up their capacity. And capacity is kind of a fancy word for supply, the supply of insurance. You have more insurance carriers that are willing to insure more things. And capacity or supply doesn't open up until these insurance carriers start to feel good. They start to feel good about their profitability. They start to feel good about their outlook on things. So, you know, we're all hoping for continued improvement in the insurance market, and that should trickle down and make life considerably easier for the historic homeowners and historic building owners in Hawaii.
Because I am ignorant about what's out there when it comes to insurance, is there any kind of government subsidized program for historic properties at all?
No, not specifically. There's no government program. There's a government program as it relates to flood insurance, which is the National Flood Insurance Plan, but I don't think that's, you know, what you're referring to. As it relates to just standard homeowners or commercial building insurance, there's not a government program. Some states do have state programs. For example, Florida has the Citizens Program, which is thought of to be the carrier of last resort. So it's kind of, well, if you can't get insurance anywhere else, then you can at least go to, you know, Citizens in Florida. So some states do have those solutions in place, but most states do not. So most states just let it be a free market. You know, there's plenty of insurance carriers, and in theory, everybody will find a home. But with where the insurance market is now, not everybody is finding a home, meaning not everybody is finding any insurance carrier that's willing to insure them. And what that does is that creates a high-risk area. So there's an area of insurance called excess and surplus lines, which is basically, some people think of it as Lloyd's of London. It's the insurance carriers that are willing to insure anything for a price. As long as the price is good, they'll do it. And it's expensive insurance. And frankly, oftentimes it's not good insurance. So what you're finding is homeowners and commercial building owners who at one time were insured with an admitted, reputable insurance carrier, like, you know, Chubb, Travelers, Hartford, the ones you've heard of, they're no longer able to find insurance carriers like that. So they're forced to go to the excess and surplus lines market. And those solutions are expensive, and also the coverage is not as good. So that's kind of the only option of last resort that exists, and there's really not a state option or a federal option out there.
Well, that doesn't bode well for historic properties.
No, it doesn't. And unfortunately, you know, that's part of the reason our organization was created. So my organization is National Trust Insurance Services. We were created 21 years ago by the National Trust for Historic Preservation to basically be a specialty agent and broker for historic property owners. And at the time, 21 years ago, it's very similar to the time it is now, which is most insurance carriers do not like to insure historic properties. And it doesn't really even matter if the historic property is completely rehabbed and in incredible shape and is stone construction and, you know, the guts, the electrical and the plumbing are all, you know, redone and everything is great. The fact that it's historic, quote unquote historic, is a deal breaker for a lot of insurance companies. They just don't want to insure an older building. Now, fortunately, for every insurance carrier that does not want to insure a historic building, there are insurance carriers that do, because, you know, there's the old adage in the world of historic buildings, which is they don't build it like they used to, right? You've heard that saying, they don't build it like they used to. And that's actually true, because historic buildings have been proven to be superior as it relates to pride of ownership. You know, the people that own historic buildings care about their historic buildings. You know, when you need a new roof, they put on a new roof. When it needs plumbing upgrades, it gets plumbing upgrades. The people that own historic buildings care for their buildings deeply. And that's been proven in the preservation space. And it's also a profitable line of business for insurance companies. The insurance companies that do insure historic buildings tend to do well because they are, you know, well-constructed buildings. And every insurance market, you're going to have people that like certain things. You're going to have insurance companies that love to write restaurants. And you're going to have carriers that don't want to write restaurants. You know, there's something for everybody. But there is definitely still a market for historic building owners, historic homeowners. It's just, how do you find them? It's a huge market out there, and it's important to kind of work with an agent that knows how to do it.
Okay, and this webinar hopefully will help steer property owners in a direction if they're kind of lost at this point.
Yeah, I mean, the goal of the webinar is more educational. So there is no, you know, magic solution to the issue that we face. It's a national crisis, I like to think. You know, we're not going to solve it on the webinar, but what we can definitely do is educate the consumers. So for the people that are being canceled by their insurance and they don't know why, for the people that are wondering, you know, they watch the nightly news and they see, you know, State Farm is pulling out of the state of California and they can't figure out why. You know, the purpose of this webinar is to really educate people as to what is happening in the insurance market, why it's happening, and then hopefully we can talk about some potential lights at the end of the tunnel. Now, at this point, it's a pretty far light at the end of the tunnel, but, you know, there's always a light at the end of the tunnel. So, you know, we'll be talking about, you know, things that could be on the horizon. This webinar is intended for people that want to educate themselves as to, you know, why we are in the position we are in.
Will that light at the end of the tunnel, you know, involve legislation on a national level, federal level, you think?
You know, I think that's the groundswell at the moment. This is a little bit over my head in terms of, you know, what's happening on Capitol Hill. But you do see more and more stories, politicians that are talking about something that needs to be done. And usually that's the precursor to some sort of bill or some sort of action on the part of Congress or the part of the House. So it's hopeful. There's certainly a lot that does need to be done. I'll also say it's a state-by-state problem. You know, there's certain states that have insurance challenges that other states don't have, you know, related to tort law and related to certain regulations that make it hard for insurance companies to do business. You know, I think of Florida, which is really, you know, aside from the geography of Florida with hurricanes and things that happen, they have issues related to just general regulations that make it hard for insurance companies to do business profitably in the state. So, it's a federal issue. It's a state-by-state issue. I do know that certain states are doing a lot to try to fix the issues in their specific areas, but I am not sure of a federal movement at this point.
That was Kevin Sullivan with the National Trust for Insurance Services. He was talking to us about next month's webinar to help owners of historic properties understand the current insurance landscape. The National Trust for Historic Preservation is presenting the forum on July 16th. In response to the insurance crisis and rising costs. We will have links to register for that webinar on the conversation page of our website later today.
Support for HPR comes from the Scheidler College of Business at UH Manoa, celebrating 75 years, offering the global MBA with 21-month, 24-month, and 36-month options. Scheidler.hawaii.edu.
HPR Generation Listen invites you to Trivia Night every first Monday of the month at Village Bottle Shop and Tasting Room in Kaka'ako. It's an opportunity to connect with fellow public radio nerds in an evening of lively but friendly competition. Gen Listen connects younger listeners and young at heart listeners with the station and with each other. Connect with us in person at HPR Gen Listen Trivia. Sign up to play at hawaiipublicradio.org/genlisten.
Support for HPR comes from the Honolulu Museum of Art. Fashioning Aloha traces the history of Aloha wear from the 1930s to the present. Now on view, honolulumuseum.org.
It was almost exactly a year ago that U.S. Secretary of the Interior Deb Haaland visited Hawaii, and during that time she announced nearly $16 million in federal funding would go towards saving our native forest birds. That money has aided efforts in Maui, including the ongoing release of sterile male mosquitoes to prevent native birds from contracting avian malaria. But it is a race against time. And what about Kauai? Well, conservation experts say the sterile male technology, also known as the incompatible insect technique, won't be available there until winter of 2025. Kelly Crampton of the Kauai Forest Bird Recovery Project spoke with the Conversation's Maddie Bender about another mosquito control method that they've recently been trying and the outlook for birds like the akakiki and akeke.
Here on Kauai, the tool we are currently using is a biolarvicide, so it's a completely safe bacteria that kills mosquito larvae and only mosquito larvae. It has no impacts on higher level invertebrates like damselflies or dragonflies or any other vertebrates like birds or pigs or dogs or humans. So we are using that to treat known high density mosquito areas here in Kauai, and we just got that project off the ground because we do not expect to have the incompatible insect technique here on Kauai until winter of 2025. And meanwhile, we have this crisis of extinction, you know, going on before our very eyes here in Kauai. So the tool available to us at this time is this biolarvicide Bacillus thuringiensis israelensis, which is used by vector control districts across the world for like 30 years to control mosquito populations.
Do you know the reason why incompatible insect technique, why you can't get that technology over to Kauai until winter?
It's a combination of getting the money together and ramping up production of these incompatible males.
Which populations of birds and which species are most affected on Kauai by avian malaria?
We have just spent the last couple of years resurveying the Kauai bird populations, and the news is pretty grim. We think that there are only a handful of akikiki left. Akeke, the official estimate from last year, is 600-something birds, but we're out there surveying them as we speak, and we are sure that there's not nearly that many, probably actually only 100 or fewer akeke. The EEV estimates on Kauai, now remember, EEV is found statewide, but on Kauai, it's only a couple hundred birds. Mm-hmm. A formerly fairly widespread species, the Anianiao, suffered a like 60% decrease between 2012 and 2018, is now only 3,500 birds, down from 10,000. I mean, it's grim. It's very definitely correlated with an increase in mosquito populations that we have observed over the last 4 years.
And how do you apply the biolarvicide? What does that actually look like in the field?
Via helicopter. These bacteria are suspended in a solution, which we mix with water to dilute it to get the correct dosage rate. And then we load it up into a tank helicopter, and it uses one of those boom sprayers like in the kids' movie Planes. I don't know if you ever saw that. And it flies over an 1,100-acre area, which is known to be a mosquito hotspot on the Alakai Plateau.
And you know from other sites or trial periods that this technique works at such a broad brush level in terms of it. Yeah,
it's exactly. Going to... Yeah, we did it. We, you know, as I said, it's been used by vector control districts for like 30 years. And we did a pilot study in the Alakai last fall, and we're able to demonstrate that it can get to the ground to where the mosquito larvae are in sufficient quantities to kill mosquito larvae.
Are you doing anything on the community engagement and like science communication front?
We have a very active community engagement program. We have been in the schools every couple of weeks this spring in particular. I don't know if you know, but it's Makahiki Onamanunarahele. Mm-hmm. This year, Year of the Forest Birds. So we are also participating in a statewide effort to get out the word about the importance and beauty of our forest birds. So we have some library talks scheduled this summer. We have an origami project with the classrooms that we hope to turn into an art exhibit this fall. I mean, just a lot of things targeted to all ages to help get the word out about what we need to do now to save the forest birds,
yeah,
which are our heritage here in Hawaii.
But ultimately, you see the biolarvicide as something to control the numbers before you can ramp up production of the...
Ideally, they would actually be used in conjunction.
Okay.
If we can find enough funding, they would be used in conjunction because they target different phases of the mosquito larvicide and they have different modes of action. So in an ideal mosquito control program, we would be doing both simultaneously. Right now, of course, we're using it to kind of hold the fort while we wait for the other tool to become available. Let's just say that we don't expect to have enough IIT mosquitoes to cover the entire plateau anytime soon. So I think there will be, for the long time, need for both tools.
And anything else you would like to add on these efforts, anything coming down the pipeline or things that listeners should know?
Yes. I mean, we do, for example, because of the emerging crisis with the Anianiau, we do expect to begin collecting Anianiau this fall to start building an insurance population of that species.
Is that almost like a last-ditch solution?
We would prefer to be recovering these species, all of them, in situ. We would prefer to be doing mosquito control and habitat improvements and predator control to make sure that we have robust populations of these species in their natural range. So we consider captive breeding and we consider translocation when we realize that we are not going to be able to mitigate the threats in the natural range. So yes, the fact that we are turning to conservation of Anianiau is an admission that we have so far been unable to address, in this case, primarily the threat of mosquitoes,
yep,
and mosquito-borne diseases for that species. And we don't think, even once we get mosquito control in 2025, it's going to take a couple more years to start seeing results on the ground. And in the meantime, we do not want to see the species dwindle any further. So we need to start thinking about insurance populations.
Is there anything that you're hopeful or optimistic about?
I mean, my hope comes from the fact that we are beginning to turn the corner on this mosquito control problem. I mean, it has been the bugaboo. Like, we just have not known how to deal with it. And now we suddenly have two tools at our disposal that we are going to be able to use to help these species. But my hope also comes from the fact that we are seeing the tide of public opinion turn in favor of these birds. There's a lot more interest from all ages in doing what we need to do to save these birds, and from all levels, right? I mean, we have more government funding to save these birds than we've ever had. So I think that we, as a society, are beginning to recognize the threat of climate change and the importance of all these species, and that we cannot afford to lose our biodiversity here in Hawaii or anywhere in the nation. And we have to take drastic measures to help these birds.
That was Callie Crampton, Program Manager of the Kauai Forest Bird Recovery Project, talking with HPR's Maddie Bender about efforts to save endangered species in this, the Year of the Forest Birds here in Hawaii. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Now it's trivia time. Coming up, your backyard quiz. Today, we're testing your knowledge of St. Damien, Born Joseph de Wooster in Belgium in 1840, he later took the name Damien as he pursued a religious profession. He arrived in Hawaii in 1864, and after entering the priesthood here, became Father Damien. In 1865, he was assigned to the Catholic mission in North Kohala on the island of Hawaii, and over the following years, he served in several parishes on Oahu, and it was in 1873 that he began his ministry to people with Hansen's disease. That's when he traveled to the Kalaupapa Peninsula on Molokai and cared for the residents there until his death in 1889. 120 years later, in 2009, he was canonized as a saint in the Catholic Church. As you would expect, several schools and churches are named after St. Damien, and that includes St. Damien of Molokai Catholic Church, which is believed to be the first named after him after sainthood. So, for today's Backyard Quiz, can you tell us where on the continent that it's located? Call 808-941-3689 or toll-free 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets a reusable tote bag from HPR.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nareit Hawaii, supporting nonprofits such as the Molokai Affordable Housing Alliance, providing kupuna with resources for building affordable homes on Molokai. NareitHawaii.com.
FestBack 2024 is all pow, but today we take a closer look at what happens with all those beautiful gifts that the participating nations brought to Hawaii. Here to talk about that is HBR's Cassie Ordonio. Good morning.
Good morning, Catherine.
Yeah, you know, Governor Josh Green mentioned on our show the other day that plans are underway to properly display those gifts so the public can appreciate all that he and the First Lady were presented with on opening day.
Yeah, and so all of those cultural gifts that the governor's office received during the FestPAC's opening ceremony, which is a significant amount, they're currently at the State Foundation of Culture and the Arts warehouse or storage facility. And the governor's office actually tasked the State Foundation on Culture and the Arts to photograph, process, and catalog each of these items by country to the state of Hawaii, and this state agency is also doing condition reports, including documentation of each gift. So that means we're going to know what these cultural gifts are and what was that relationship and which specific nation or territory it came from.
Yeah, because, I mean, watching it on TV, it was just an amazing array of items that they brought, from big canoes to, you know, just all kinds of really interesting artifacts.
Including 74 feet of tapa from Tonga, made by, from what the delegate said, was 100 men, 100 women, 100% made in Tonga. That delegate made it very clear. And also, I don't know if you saw in the very beginning, I think it was Wallace and Futuna, they also gifted a kava plant or the root of kava. I'm not too sure how that got past the state agriculture, but...
Oh, I'm sure it got inspected.
Oh, yeah. But here's like some other gifts that were given to Josh Green.
We have traveled long and far to bring the very best of our cultures and traditions. As a sacred customary practice of our people, we must bring you gifts. It's called tafuluai. The tafuluai is a traditional shell money from people of the Malaita province of Solomon Island. Its purpose are many. It is used for dowry, compensation, and the most important gift, to cement friendships and relationships.
And I spoke with Adam Jansen of the Hawaii State Archives, and he says it's important to preserve the condition and history of these artifacts, not just because of the item itself, it's to preserve the symbol and the history behind it.
When that culture comes back again for a visit, these are artifacts that need to be tracked so that we can put them on prominent display to show this new delegation look at our long and storied history between our two nations. And so because of that, making sure that they stay in pristine condition becomes very important, because if these individuals are going to travel across the seas and bring these incredible gifts to us, you know, they put all that care into the creation and the transport, the least we can do is make sure that they are maintained in the condition in which they were gifted, that they are tracked, that it's understood who gifted this, when did they gift it, why did they gift it, so that all of that information stays with that, so that we can continue to look at it and remember what an incredible event that was and the intent behind it.
So the Hawaii State Archives doesn't have administrative authority. So if a government official or state official were to receive what's considered a protocol gift, like for FESPAC, that administrative person or government official, the state archives, they can't just say, hey, give us that gift so we can archive it right away. It's going to be up to Governor Josh Green to decide, like, hey, I want to work with, let's say, the SFCA, or I want to work with the state archives here. Let's preserve this. And Adam Jansen actually made it clear what happens when you don't preserve an artifact.
This is an unprecedented event. To have this many visitors of prominence come bearing gifts is really unprecedented within Hawaii. You know, we've never hosted FESPAC before, so we didn't have 28 nations come and have their delegations here. So this is really kind of new waters for us. But we have some experience with these protocol level gifts in that when Governor Ige's administration left, they did a really deep clean of the office and found a lot of items that had been gifted to previous administrations, going back to, I think, as far as Ariyoshi, and boxed up 19 boxes worth of these protocol gifts and gave them to the archives for safekeeping. The difficulty is, as we look back now, 30, 40 years, we don't know who gifted who some of these objects. It's just this incredible cultural object in a glass case with no markings on it of any kind. So we really have lost that connection to that event.
Yeah, it's so important, the documentation. So it's a shame that we've lost some of that information. But thank goodness we still have those gifts and we can preserve it. Because we know how it is with protocol, right? When somebody of standing comes and, let's say, plants a tree here in Hawaii, when they come back again, they go back to visit that tree to see how well we have taken care of that gift. It's a thing of respect.
And there were past efforts from the Hawaii State Archives who advocated for bills that would basically clarify that protocol gift and how to document it properly. But that was in, 2023 and the legislative year 2022 when those bills were introduced, but they never made it to the full floor and never became law. It's unclear if it's going to be reintroduced in the coming years, but it's more of like a wait and see. But it is, Adam Jansen did emphasize, it is important to document not just the artifact itself, but the history and the symbolism of the relationship that the state of Hawaii has built with those Pacific nations.
Right. So FESPAC has really put the spotlight on this issue, and maybe lawmakers will take something up next session.
And then there's also been questions about what is going to happen with these gifts. I mean, we do know that the State Foundation of Culture and the Arts is documenting these gifts and artifacts right now. But I remember, I know Josh Green was on your show, and he did state that these gifts are for the people of Hawaii, and they're trying to get it on display. I believe it's sometime by summer or fall of this year, and public display, actually. So they're still trying to figure out between the governor's office and the SFCA if that public display is either going to be at Bishop Museum, the State Museum, or if they're going to alternate these artifacts between like Hawaii and the other counties as well, so everyone can have a fair chance to see these gifts.
That would be really nice if they were to go to the neighbor islands.
This was something that I was questioning when I first was doing the story, is that if the governor is allowed to keep these gifts personally. And I spoke with Robert Harris of the State Ethics Commission to help clarify the part of the gifts law.
The state ethics law applies to all state employees and legislators. And with regards to gifts, It prohibits anything that might be reasonably inferred to either influence or reward that state employee. There are several exceptions to the gift law that are sort of what we consider nominal or de minimis, like flower lay. However, if the item doesn't fit within one of those exceptions, then we typically look at a couple of different factors and whether or not they can accept that personally. With regards to an event or a special occasion, we would typically consider those gifts to be gifts to the state. And so therefore, they are part of Hawaii's history and culture, and that they are something that should be preserved for the people of Hawaii going forward.
And Robert Harris did say that the State Ethics Commission is looking on updating their administrative rules to be more specific when looking at gifts given to state individuals or the state as a whole. But speaking back on FESPAC, I mean, this is like a cultural protocol for all Pacific Islanders to show their gratitude when they're invited to such events.
The last gift, Your Excellency, is called a spirit mask. It comes in a pair. Some people mistakenly call them devil mask. No, it's not the devil mask. It's the angel's mask. This one is typically used in two in the old days for warfare. It symbolizes the warriors of the islands. But today, we use it to get money in tourism. Please, I have a request. Don't sell them here. Tell your visitors to come by in two.
Oh, I love that. Yeah, I mean, you feel their pain, right? They do want visitors, to help with their economy, just like we want the Japanese to come back. But yeah, that was a fun moment. He had a great sense of humor.
He definitely did. And the next FESPAC, I know, is going to be held in New Caledonia in 2028.
All right. Well, we can't wait. But thank you so much, Cassie.
Thanks for having me.
We've been talking to HPR's Cassie Ordonio. Look, you can check out her coverage on FESPAC on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for HPR comes from the Office of Hawaiian Affairs, committed to supporting Native Hawaiian homeowners and renters impacted by the Maui wildfires. More about its Kanaho grant at oha.org/kanaho grant.
Hey there, it's Michael Barbaro, host of The Daily. Join us for an in-depth look into the world's biggest stories. Catch The Daily Monday through Thursday at 1:30 here on HPR One.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Outrigger Resorts and Hotels, featuring the sights and sounds of beaches throughout the islands, live music, and cultural experiences. Learn more at outrigger.com.
Now it's time for the backyard quiz answer. Earlier we asked you where the first church on the U.S. continent, named after St. Damien, is located. Damien initially arrived in Honolulu in 1864. He became Father Damien later that year after he was ordained into priesthood at what is now the Cathedral of Our Lady of Peace on Oahu. In 1873, he volunteered to relocate to Kalaupapa Molokai to care for Hansen's disease patients who were exiled there. He remained there until his death in 1889. His life and works have been the subject of several books and films and monuments. There is a statue honoring him on the steps of Hawaii's Capitol building. Several schools are named after him, including one in Canada and one right here on Oahu. And in 2010, construction of the St. Damien of Molokai Catholic Church in Edmond, Oklahoma, was finished. It's believed to be the first church on the continental U.S. to be named after him following sainthood. We had no winners for this today, but that was our quiz. If you have one you'd like to share, write to TalkBack at hawaiipublicradio.org.
When you support HPR, you support storytelling that illuminates understanding.
Our obligation was to each other, and the unwritten rule was this: we all come back or nobody comes back.
My son was in the Air Force, and he's a wounded warrior. He was severely injured in Afghanistan at just the precious age of his early 20s.
We hear stories that remind us of our humanity.
This was something that happened, as they say, a normal reaction to abnormal circumstances.
My service in combat, my service in Vietnam, probably is the singular most event or experience that I had that put me on a path to where I am today.
Help HPR uplift more community voices. Donate at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Adaptive Frameworks is the title of an art exhibit now open on the Big Island. It's the work of Chenta Lowry, a Maui-based educator and textile artist who works in fiber traditions that are important to our identity. She taps into African-American patchwork quilting, Finnish felting, and kapa, or bark cloth, traditions of the Pacific. The Conversation's Lillian Song sat down with Lowry to talk about her process of making small detail pieces that are combined to make large, immersive installations.
This is the second showing of this group of works. The first time it showed was last September at the Schaefer International Gallery on Maui. And it's a collection of pieces all made out of fiber. I use wool, I use roots that I've harvested locally, and kapa or kapa made from bark cloth. There's also a cotton crochet piece in there. And the work is under the title of Adaptive Frameworks because I'm really looking at exploring adaptation in different ways and the concept of adaptation. But if you were to look at individual pieces, you might see things that remind you of patchwork quilting. Most of the pieces are actually smaller pieces that are then combined to make larger pieces. And conceptually, that's really intentional. I'm really interested in this idea of what it is to be a part of a larger whole and the relationship between individual parts to larger wholes. So everything is really done by hand, hand-felted large pieces of wool, turning it into felt, and then I've cut it up and then re-stitched it back together in different arrangements. I've done the same with the kapa, making large pieces of the spark cloth that have been cut up and then re-sewn together. There's a large root installation, which is made up of different configurations of smaller squares connected to make larger panels.
Hmm. And for us as the audience, we are seeing the finished product. But you as the artist, share a backstory to help us understand how you arrive at the piece. Or when do you finish? When do you say, okay, this is it?
It's different every time. Unlike a painting where I think you could continue to just paint over and change your mind. Working with fibers and a lot of my work, there's a process, a very clear process that has to be followed when you're making kapa or when you're felting. But the piece I want to just speak to is called Limbo. It's the big installation piece of roots. They're ironwood roots that I harvested and soaked and then wove into these 4x4 panels. There are 21 of them, which is somewhat arbitrary, but I had that as a goal. And the concept for the piece began years ago when I was just hearing on the news about the refugee crisis and the flow of migrants into Europe from Syria. That's when I first began to just ponder, you know, what does it mean to have to be uprooted and leave your home? And I had this idea of just literal roots being suspended, like you would, you know, like you see a tree, the base of a tree roots kind of going in every which direction. But again, like, you know, I didn't have space for it. I didn't quite know how I would make that. And then fast forward to 2020 and just the news shifting focus to the lines of migrants coming up from the southern border into the U.S. and thinking about, again, being uprooted, being in limbo, waiting for these systems, these social systems, to allow people to enter, and just how broken the systems are. And in the meantime, all of these human beings are just living in the state of insecurity and not being able to settle. And so that's when this idea of, okay, using actual roots and not trying to kind of imitate like the form of a root system, but rather using roots to bend them and form them into these more rigid grid shape, these squares, right? Where all of the natural extension that happens with roots are instead they're bound and contorted to fit into these squares. That's when I had the idea to do that. And I knew I wanted them suspended. I knew I wanted them to not touch the ground. And I liked the idea of them creating these shadows that would be reflected on the walls and sort of to speak to the generations and the layers of people who are affected by just being in suspense. And what was really moving to me about that piece is my show at the Schaefer Gallery was scheduled to open almost exactly 1 month after the fires here in Lahaina. And the concept started so far, right, across the ocean in Europe. But once the show opened, I felt like it was so many members of my immediate community were just in that exact, had been this upheaval and were in limbo and living, you know, we're in the strange state of suspension and just the pain of all of that. And I felt like this piece spoke to me and hopefully to the community. It just gained a whole nother layer of meaning and just a reminder that it's everywhere. And so many people don't have a place to set down roots and to grow and to get to a place where they can thrive. That piece is at Kahilu Gallery now, but it was also after the Pu'uhonua series, I made a counter piece to this limbo installation, and that piece was called Receive. And the whole idea behind that was, what would it look like? What would a Pu'uhonua be where people could sort of land and begin to set roots and to flourish? So both of those pieces were really important to me as a way of meeting the time, although again, like I finished them both before the fires actually began, but it just helped me as an artist who works in my little studio away from life in many ways feel like I was meeting the world in a meaningful and relevant way.
You're still in touch with your community, with humanity through the work you're doing. So even though created in that space of the studio, but because of how you're thinking or what you're thinking about, able to connect and having them when they see your work. And I think that's the beauty of contemporary art now, where we can actually speak to the artist or understand purpose as versus going to an art history lecture and then having a teacher tell me what that artist was doing at the time and what, you know, expressed belief that they were going through, right? So this is the beauty of contemporary art where, you know, you're having real time and space issues filtering through your life, and how are you processing those emotions? How are you sharing what you feel is important with others? And I think that's the beauty of art today. So when someone goes to your exhibits.
Yes, that is correct. And as the artist, I know that to be true through and through when I go and engage with other people's work. But sometimes as an artist, I need reminding of that when I'm, you know, in my little process of meaning making and creation to trust, right? It's trust that what is meaningful to me might also touch the lives of others and be meaningful for them as well and serve them as well.
And with these exhibits, with your pieces out in the world, though, you get to spark conversations or thoughts because you've already released them into the world. And knowing that that was how, you know, the ideas are out there, the fact that, you know, you're talking about being displaced, refugees, the fact that, you know, it's hard to root in some places where there are war zones. stuff like that. You're making us think.
Yes. And it's right. Ever more, just every day, the news is, you just see it everywhere. And it is heartbreaking, but it's also what moves us to reflect and to have time to reflect. And I think that is, you know, the role of artists, to channel that into ways that can move others and share, you know, bring a, hopefully a new lens and change the world, because it seems like that's what's needed. Yeah.
Right. And knowing that when we look at your pieces, they're very labor intensive. It takes time. I mean, just when you think of making kapa, it is step intensive. I saw you just pounding. For you, as you're going through this process, putting into an exhibit, putting it out into the world, what would you like to leave your audiences with?
I do hope that people are able to reflect on the natural world in a different way. I think, you know, with all of the advancements with technology and moving so quickly, and I think we don't often think about the implications and at the pace of which the world is moving. And my practice is really labor intensive and slow. And I really value the fact that it takes me out into the natural world and that I'm observing these natural processes, which are much, much slower. And I wonder if not everybody has the patience to engage in slower processes. So I hope that it invites people to reflect on sort of the concepts that are kind of inherent in the work, but also on their relationship to the natural world and the value of the materials and resources that are inherent in the natural world that surround us, so that we kind of take care of and place higher value on the natural resources that support life.
That was textile artist Chenta Lowry and HBR's Lillian Song. Lowry's exhibit, Adaptive Frameworks, runs through July 21st at Kahilo's Simperman Galley on the Big Island. She debuted a similar show at Maui's Schaefer International Gallery in the months following the Lahaina fires. That is it for us today. Tomorrow, we plan to check in with Kauai Mayor Derek Kawakami, just back from a conference on the mainland. We do welcome feedback. Call our talkback line at 808-792-8217. You can find The Conversation as a podcast on Google, Spotify, Apple, or on our website. I'm Catherine Cruz. We'll be back tomorrow with more of The Conversation.